The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. In the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And first, I'm going to finish up the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2022. The first thing I'm going to read is a short article entitled Atrial Fibrillation After Surgery, Common and Undertreated. After surgery, unrelated to the heart, a diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, a heart rhythm disorder that raises the risk of stroke, may be more common than previously thought. And these cases appear to be undertreated. According to a study published July 25, 2022, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, among the 4,231 people in the study, 13% had their first ever bout of atrial fibrillation after surgery, unrelated to the heart, most often within a week of the operation. Stress and inflammation related to surgery may trigger atrial fib, the researchers postulated. Compared with people who developed atrial fib unrelated to a surgery procedure, those diagnosed with atrial fib following surgery were less likely to be taking anti-clotting drugs to lower their risk of stroke. The common perception that atrial fib that emerges after surgery is less serious than other types of atrial fib may be due to blame for this discrepancy. However, during the average follow-up of just over 6 years, both groups, in other words, those who had atrial fib unrelated to surgery and those who were diagnosed with atrial fib after surgery, had similar risks for stroke, transient ischemic attack, and death, the researchers found. Now here's another short article from the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2022 that's entitled Light During Sleep is Linked to Conditions That Harm the Heart. Older adults who were exposed to light while sleeping at night were more likely to have obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes than adults who slept in darkness. The study included 552 adults aged 63 to 84 who were part of the Chicago Healthy Aging Study. In addition to being assessed for factors that raise heart disease risk, like high blood pressure and diabetes, they all wore devices that measured the amount of light in their bedrooms over a week. Fewer than half the participants consistently had a five-hour stretch of complete darkness every day. The rest were exposed to some light even during their darkest periods, usually in the middle of the night. These observational findings cannot prove that nighttime light exposure makes obesity and other heart-related risks more likely. But light during sleep may disrupt the body's internal clock and trigger other changes that affect normal metabolism. The findings were published online June 22, 2022, by the journal Sleep. And finally, the last article from the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2022 is entitled Bleeding Problems, Know Your Risk. Clot-preventing drugs can leave you vulnerable to minor or more dangerous bleeding. Certain health conditions and medications can raise that risk. Many people with heart disease take medications that help prevent blood clots, which are responsible for causing most heart attacks and strokes. But these medications, often referred to as blood thinners, have a well-known and fairly common side effect, a heightened risk of bleeding. Unexpected bleeding can range from minor problems like bruises and bleeding gums to a very serious complication, including bleeding in the brain, says cardiologist Dr. Gregory Piazza, associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Many factors can magnify a person's risk of bleeding, especially advancing age. Older people are more likely to have one or more other health conditions that make them prone to bleeding. They're also more likely to be taking an anti-clotting mechanism. Clot-preventing drugs fall into two main categories, anticoagulants and antiplatelet drugs. People who have atrial fibrillation or a mechanical heart valve take anticoagulants because they want to prevent strokes. These drugs are also prescribed following surgery to prevent blood clots in the legs, a condition known as deep vein thrombosis. Most heart attack survivors take daily aspirin to prevent repeat heart attacks, but this antiplatelet drug is no longer routinely recommended to prevent a first heart attack, because for most people, the risk of bleeding outweighs the risk of heart attack. Other antiplatelet drugs are given during and after a heart attack, and when a person receives a stent, a tiny mesh tube that props open a blocked artery. Some people take anticoagulants and antiplatelet drugs together. Certain chronic health conditions can leave people more likely to experience bleeding. For example, liver disease can affect blood levels of factors involved in clotting, and kidney disease can affect normal platelet function. Blood vessel changes related to diabetes and cancer can also predispose people to bleeding. One large group of medications that increase bleeding risk are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, including the over-the-counter pain relievers ibuprofen or Advil and naproxen or Aleve, as well as the prescription NSAIDs like celecoxib or Celebrex and diclofenac or Cambia. Steroids, which are used to treat conditions like inflammatory bowel disease and rheumatoid arthritis, can also raise bleeding risk. That's true even if you take a steroid like prednisone for just 7 to 10 days to treat a flare-up of disease, says Dr. Piazza. Technically, anti-clotting drugs don't cause bleeding per se. Bleeding results from a breach in the wall of a blood vessel. But anti-clotting drugs interfere with your body's normal reaction to quell microscopic amounts of bleeding, which may continue unabated and become more serious. And of course, when they say anti-clotting drugs, they're referring to drugs like Eliquis, Pradaxa, Xarelto, and the antiplatelet drugs Plavix, Effient, and Brilinta. What are the warning signs? Some people who take anti-clotting drugs notice bleeding after shaving with a razor, or they have nosebleeds. Frequent or large bruises are a potential worrisome sign. Be sure to tell your doctor if you have these symptoms. Seek medical care right away if you have more serious symptoms. More serious symptoms would include tea-colored pink or red urine, which might mean bleeding in the urinary tract, blood in your stools or black tarry stools, and a sudden severe headache, which could mean bleeding in the brain. Brain bleeds can be life-threatening. If you're taking an anti-clotting drug and have any sort of head trauma, even just bumping your head on a door frame, you should go to the emergency room, Dr. Piazza says. If the scan reveals any bleeding, you'll receive medication to counteract the anti-clotting drug and any other necessary treatment. Now I'm going to complete the September 2022 Mayo Clinic health letter, reading a section called Second Opinion. Question. My doctor suggested that I take vaginal estrogen therapy for postmenopausal vaginal dryness. I've heard that taking hormones could increase the risk of breast cancer. Should I be concerned? Hormone therapy is commonly used to treat the symptoms of menopause. However, the two main categories of menopausal hormone therapy are very different. The first is systemic hormone therapy. This is given as a pill, a patch, a gel, or a spray. And this estrogen goes through the whole body to treat symptoms like hot flashes and night sweats. It is also used to treat and prevent osteoporosis. Estrogen stimulates growth of the lining of the uterus when not balanced by progesterone, and this can lead to uterine cancer. So women who have not had their uterus removed will need combination hormone therapy that also includes progestin, a progesterone-like medication, to counterbalance estrogen's effects. By contrast, there are vaginal estrogen treatments, which are creams, rings, capsules, or tablets that deliver a low dose of estrogen directly in the vagina. This therapy treats menopausal symptoms in the vulva, vagina, and urinary tract, like vaginal dryness, incontinence, and recurrent infection. Low-dose vaginal estrogen like this does not increase your risk of breast cancer. It also doesn't increase the risk of uterine cancer or blood clots. This is because the estrogen is not absorbed at significant amounts into the body. While the package insert that's required for these vaginal preparations lists all of these as possible adverse effects, it does not account for the limited absorption of these products applied to the vaginal tissue directly. GSM, which means the genitourinary syndrome of menopause, doesn't lessen with time like mood swings and hot flashes do. For mild or moderate vaginal dryness and other symptoms, non-hormonal vaginal moisturizers can be purchased. These can be tried first or in addition to low-dose vaginal estrogen. Vaginal treatments can be used for many years in women, and they often are. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter of September 2022. And I'm going to turn first to a section called From the Doctor by Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. And this section is called The Rise of Computational Medicine. Dr. Komaroff begins, "Medical research is in the midst of the big data revolution. What is it? Until the past 20 years, most laboratory research involved simple ideas that could be tested by simple experiments. 70 years ago, the biochemist Linus Pauling discovered the cause of sickle cell disease. In this disease, misshapen red blood cells clog up small blood vessels, leading children and young adults to have recurrent bouts of excruciating pain, even strokes and heart attacks. appalling bet that the children had inherited a defect in a specific protein called globin that caused the protein and then the red blood cell to become misshapen. The simple idea led to a simple experiment. He put globin from people with and without the disease into a gel. Then he turned on an electrical current that caused the globin to move through the gel. Diseased globin moved differently from healthy globin. Anyone could see the difference, just looking at the gel. No fancy analysis was necessary. For a few years, it seemed possible that most diseases might be caused by a defect in a single protein or other type of molecule. If so, perhaps simple cures would follow. Unfortunately, by the 1970s, it had become clear that inside every cell are thousands of molecules of different types. These include proteins and nucleic acids. The cause of most disease involved the interaction of many of these different molecules. That meant that with most disease, one would have to analyze thousands of molecules to figure out what was wrong. However, in the 1970s, such analysis was not possible. Scientists could not identify which molecules were the abnormal ones. They could only guess. And the guesses were often wrong, clever, but wrong. Unfortunately, the effort to identify every one of our roughly 20,000 genes accomplished not only that remarkable feat, but also led to the development of technologies that simultaneously analyze thousands of molecules of different types. Even 30 years ago, few scientists imagined that this could be possible in their lifetime. Unlike Pauling's experiment, these experiments involved thousands of molecules and require very fancy analysis, new mathematical techniques to make sense out of the thousands of numbers. This is called big data. The big data is generated with each experiment. A whole new field called computational medicine emerged. At Harvard Medical School, we have created a large department dedicated to developing such computational medicine techniques and to training young scientists to use and teach them. The new world of big data in biomedical research has brought about another change. Today, we don't always need a bright idea to advance science. We now have the tools to compare tissue from people with and without a disease and ask, what molecules are different? Guessing what might be different is no longer essential. Now we can just let nature speak for itself. Continuing with the Harvard Health Letter, the next article is called Three Common Mouth Problems and How to Cope with Them. And those common mouth problems are canker sores, dry mouth, and thrush. Dental problems aren't the only source of a mouthful of pain. Sometimes problems unrelated to the teeth make it difficult to eat, talk, smile, concentrate, or rest without discomfort. These conditions may have simple fixes you can try at home. If discomfort gets worse, you'll need to speak with your primary care doctor or to an ear, nose, and throat specialist. Here are three common mouth problems and what you can do about them. And the first is canker sores. They're also called aphthous ulcers, A-P-H-T-H-O-U-S. Canker sores are just a few millimeters wide, but they often cause severe pain. They develop in the lining of the mouth or gums, and they have a daunting appearance. They're usually round, white or yellow, and ringed with red. Canker sores may look like cancers of the mouth, but they are different. Canker sores don't invade the underlying tissue. That's what differentiates them from cancer, says Dr. Alan Feng, a head and neck surgeon and assistant professor of otolaryngology, which is head and neck surgery, at Harvard Medical School. What are the causes of canker sores? There are many different causes. These include a weakened immune system, stress, irritation from braces or dentures, biting your cheek by accident, over-vigorous toothbrushing, food allergies, or a vitamin deficiency. To ease pain, Dr. Feng recommends taking over-the-counter painkillers like Tylenol or Advil, swishing over-the-counter liquid and acids like Maalox around the mouth, or rinsing with a prescription mouthwash that contains lidocaine. To reduce further irritation, ice the canker sore before eating. Avoid spicy or salty foods, and rinse your mouth with warm salt water before and after meals. If what you think is a canker sore doesn't heal after 2 weeks, or if it gets bigger, you should see your doctor to make sure the sore isn't a sign of an autoimmune disease or a developing cancer. Try to catch the problem early. Precancerous ulcers are unusual, but when they occur, minor procedures can prevent them from progressing. And then the second common mouth problem that's discussed is dry mouth. If you have a dry mouth once in a while, it may just be a sign that you need more fluids. But as we age, it's common to develop chronic dry mouth, which is called xerostomia, xerostomia. Dry mouth makes it hard to taste or eat. The lack of lubrication in the mouth can lead to problems chewing and swallowing, Dr. Feng says. And chronic dry mouth can have many different causes. It could be an age-related decline in saliva, or it could be a side effect of medication, drugs that treat incontinence, depression, and allergies are common causers of dry mouth. Other causes include autoimmune disease, like Sjogren's syndrome, or a side effect from treatment for cancer in the head or neck. How do you treat a dry mouth? Well, temporary fixes to ease discomfort from dry mouth include chewing sugar-free gum, which stimulates saliva production, and using a saliva substitute. Saliva substitutes include glycerin and water mixes, and there's one called Moistir, Moistir. Another one is carboxymethyl cellulose gels like Salivart, Salivart. And another one is a mucopolysaccharide ointment that's called Mouth Coat, Mouth, new word, Kote. For severe cases of dry mouth, your doctor may prescribe a medication like pilocarpine or sevimoline. These are called Salagen and Evozac. But there's no magic fix for chronic dry mouth. You have to treat the underlying problem. So if it's caused by a medication, talk to your doctor about switching to a different medication. If an autoimmune disease causes a dry mouth, you need to start or alter your treatment. Also, get enough fluid throughout the day so you can produce enough saliva to coat your mouth. To find out how many ounces of fluid you need daily, divide your body weight in pounds by 3. So in other words, a 150-pound person needs 50 ounces a day of fluids in the form of beverages and food. That's about 6 cups. Finally, another important mouth problem is thrush. Thrush is an overgrowth of the fungus Candida albicans. That's C-A-N-D-I-D-A, new word, A-L-B-I-C-A-N-S. It shows up as white patches or sores on the tongue, cheeks, roof of the mouth, and throat. Thrush can make eating, swallowing, and speaking painful. Candida albicans is naturally present in the mouth, but bacteria and a healthy immune system keep it under control. However, certain conditions like diabetes or AIDS allow it to thrive, causing thrush. Taking antibiotics, getting cancer treatments, wearing dentures, smoking, having dry mouth, and using steroid inhalers can all lead to thrush. How is thrush treated? Thrush may resolve on its own after a few weeks. Until then, you should swish over-the-counter liquid antacids in the mouth, rinse with salt water, or use prescription mouthwash with lidocaine. You should be careful to brush your teeth regularly. If you wear dentures, remove and scrub them at night. Even better, you should call your doctor for antifungal medication to treat thrush. You should see an improvement in a few days, Dr. Feng says. It's typically gone in a few weeks. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.